Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. This program is supported by San Juan Health Partners Urology, providing a wide range of personalized services for the whole family, including children. Our caring professionals are dedicated to helping meet your urology health needs with skill, experience, and service you need. For a complete listing of our services and to learn more, visit sanjuanhealthpartners.com or call 505-609-6300. San Juan Health Partners Urology, a division of San Juan Regional Medical Center. Well, let me turn to my guest who is waiting patiently for me to introduce him this morning from his home in the Taos area, and he's joining us via Skype this morning. Once again, welcoming back to KSJE, Paul Reed is here. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
Thanks for being here and for connecting with us, and looks like a sunny day in the Taos area this morning.
Yeah, beautiful day.
Good.
You know, who knows if we'll get more snow in April.
Well, I wouldn't bet against it at this point, seeing what the weather has done. But this morning you suggested a topic that I thought was really interesting, and that is the connection with using the new science, really relatively new science, of DNA in your field of archaeology, because I know we've talked before a little bit about how much DNA evidence is helping to maybe answer some of these long unanswered questions that you and your colleagues have had, correct?
Right. I mean, like you said, in the last maybe 10 years, 15 years, we've just had, I think, what people would describe as revolutionary advances with the DNA testing, the genetic testing, and then comparing that to what we already knew from archaeology and what we're continuing to learn. And, you know, I think it's really opened up a whole lot of new areas of research and really answered some questions. And of course, generated dozens of other questions.
Well, of course, like anything will. But and it's also prompted a pretty interesting business model too, where anybody can now send off material and have DNA test results in our own for our own families, correct? And you've got some news about that as well.
That's right. So so we can do this for, you know, the oldest material. I think they've gotten DNA from you know, some human remains that were 60, 70,000 years old. So way, way, way in the past, we can extract, the scientists can extract the DNA, and then we can do this ourselves at home. You know, the kits that five or six different companies offer now, you pretty much just swab your cheek and then seal that Q-tip like swab, you know, in a little vial, send a couple of those off, and, you know, poof, 6 to 8 weeks later, they come back and tell you, at least according to their model,
right,
talks about where you fall on this ethnic continuum and where it's most likely, you know, that your DNA derives from. So, it's fascinating. You know, there's certainly been a lot of talk about this and some criticism as well, which we can talk about, because, you know, I think the thing that folks need to realize from the outset of the discussion is that this type of scientific testing is what we call probabilistic. It's not deterministic. So basically you send in your data, your DNA, you know, from the cheek swabs,
right,
and then it's compared to hundreds, well, not hundreds, ideally tens of thousands, millions even, of samples, and individual bits of your DNA are put up in a program, and then they see basically where those different segments of your DNA match what we already know for these samples of population worldwide.
Right.
So, yeah, it's, you know, and of course the science is a little more complicated, but, you know, it's interesting. We could go through some of the basic stuff if you want to start there.
Sure.
Essentially there's three types of tests that they'll do. They'll do one that's called autosomal, which is basically just sampling all the DNA in the nucleus of your cells. So that is DNA inherited from both mom and dad. And then that gets compared to other people who've done those types of tests. There's a whole line of testing now called Y chromosome testing, which, you know, as you might expect from the Y line, this is the male line. So what they do for different groups is, if, you know, my surname, of course, is Reed, so I could send samples to a company that did Y chromosome testing, and they would basically compare me to a long line of Reeds, and then sort of figure out where I fell in that line, maybe pull out, you know, some relatives that I wasn't aware of.
Right.
And I think that's pretty accurate, if I'm remembering it correctly, for about six generations back. You know, which isn't too bad. And then there's mitochondrial DNA testing, which comes not from the nucleus of the cells, which the other techniques use, but from the mitochondria, which are these floating, you know, bodies, for lack of a better description, in the cells. These also have DNA, but these are inherited pretty much through the female line. So if, you know, and as a male, you could do this and see what your female line related to, but particularly interesting for women to track back through mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, all the way back. So there's these different ways to do this. You know, most people do just the sort of the mass testing, the autosomal approach.
Right.
And then get compared to samples from all over the place. But when I said it was probabilistic and not deterministic, you know, these companies will come back and say that, you know, this is your ethnic breakdown. And they report it with what I would describe as perhaps too much confidence.
Oh, okay.
Also, this is absolutely, you know, where you're falling. And sometimes getting down to a specific, you know, modern nation state country, like, you know, you're 90% from Germany. But one of the flaws with the testing, or one of the things to keep in mind, is that when people send these in, they ask you to sort of self-report on what your ancestry is or what you think it is. So, and then so the samples get grouped in part by what users are saying about, well, this is my heritage. And those may or may not be accurate. And of course, once you get into a database with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of samples, some of that variation evens out. The other thing we know, of course, as we've talked on the show many times, is people move around a lot. You know,
true, right.
People talk about stability, and certainly we have, especially in the American Southwest, examples of long-term stability for our Native American groups who've been in a particular spot for maybe 1,000 years or even 1,500. But if we go over to Europe in particular, and certainly Asia and Africa, we have just a big flow of population back and forth. So if your testing comes back and says, you know, your ethnicity is 90% German, for example, there's no telling exactly what that might mean for you. So anyway, you know, the internet abounds with stories of people who are like, yeah, I'm 100%, you know, French, German. They run their DNA and it comes back, you know, Czech Republic, maybe England, Scandinavia.
Sure. You know?
So anyway, it's you know, I think it's these are very useful tools, and certainly very useful tools in what we do in archaeology, but they're not absolute and they're not deterministic. So
that's right.
Something to keep in mind as we try to assess them.
Okay. And I think the old phrase comes to mind, you get what you pay for. So if I'm paying $80, $100 to get my test results, it may not be quite as detailed as maybe someone in your line of work who's paying a lot more than that to study some type of DNA sample that you have discovered.
That's right. That's right. And even, you know, for sort of the kits that you do at home, you can spend up to $1,000 and do all the tests. If you're a male, you can do the Y chromosome, you can do the mitochondrial, you can do the autosomal, and then you can have them basically go through a greater exploration of the markers in the DNA. So, and they typically do sort of a minimal number on that for your $80 or whatever. If you go to the $200 level or $300 level, they'll add lots and lots of markers. And then, so you'll learn more, potentially. But then by the time you get to that level of detailed testing, you know, the database that they're comparing that to is a lot smaller than it is for sort of the mass testing. You know, so even then, you know,
right,
you get results, the results that you get. The interesting thing that they found, too, with some different blind tests is that, you know, from different companies, you can get fairly dramatically different results. And that's where the whole notion of the probabilistic nature of it really comes back, you know, and what we have to keep in mind. You know, I can give you an example from my own testing. I did this last year, and so I did it with a company called MyHeritage, which is also a genealogical company, just like Ancestry. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit smaller. They have several million users. I think Ancestry is up in the 20 million, you know, category there. But I had already done some genealogical work and built a pretty detailed family tree with MyHeritage. So I thought, this is probably the group for me to test with. So I went ahead and did that. And mine came back 97.3% Ireland, Scotland, Wales with them, potentially England. But they were pretty specific for me.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, I've often believed and said, based on the genealogical work I've done, that I'm Irish American, and it seems to be borne out, at least in these tests, that the minor percentage of my ancestry came back as about 2% North Africa. So this is Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, potentially.
Right.
And then a little less than 1% from Nigeria, which was very interesting. But the major percentage was up in Northwest Europe. So what you can do once you have these data is you can plug them into other online programs where basically you can put your data through a different set of tests and algorithms. So I did that with a couple, and just to illustrate briefly, did it for another company. That one also came back 97% British Isles, Northern France, and I think maybe the extreme tip of Scandinavia. So that one pushed it out a little geographically, but pretty much corroborated it. The interesting part of that second test was that the minor percentage, so the less than 3%, didn't have any relationship to Africa in this other test, but put me up in Lithuania, Estonia, in the Baltics, with a little bit of potential for northern Poland and sort of extreme western Russia.
Right.
You know, the other thing that I, you know, when I got those, you know, the major part confirming sort of the tests on both with both companies, and then the minor part, I read into that a little more. And essentially what I learned was that those minor percentages have to be treated pretty, you know, I don't know, with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I was going to ask about maybe the margin of error when we see those in maybe polls and things that are surveys of political candidates and things like that. There's always that margin of error. Could be as high as 10%, 7%, or things like that. I assume it's much the same maybe in something like this. This is their best educated guess with the data and the materials that you sent them, but there's got to still be a little bit of some wiggle room there, I suppose, right?
Exactly. And when you get down to those low percentages, they say below 10%, particular, but especially below 5%, that you really shouldn't put a ton of stock in that. You know, and that's, you know, that's what it is. So if you look at the big numbers, that's kind of maybe where you want to hang your hat. And so for me, with what I'd done with the genealogy and the family history and the DNA, those meshed up real well. So the other example is my wife Tristan just had this done. Her results came back, and they really didn't corroborate what she knew from family history and some of the genealogy.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, her last name is Kuczynski. It's a very Polish last name. I can't pronounce it the way it's supposed to be pronounced in Polish. So she felt like, you know, there was likely to be a strong component there. What she got back, her major percentage was 48% in the Balkans. So she had Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary. So a little bit south of Poland.
Right.
You know, yeah. By not really a lot of distance, 50 kilometers or so, but not like an epicenter in Poland. So she thought that was a little surprising. And then she came out 38% English, not British Isles, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, England, but just England. And, you know, her folks had said that, you know, they had some Irish, but it looks like it's actually English. And then she had 14% Scandinavia. So, and she actually has a grandmother whose family was from there. So that, you know, that certainly kind of lines up. But, you know, some of the larger narratives don't always fit when you do this testing. And, you know, that's interesting. But there certainly are tales of people being really upset because they knew they were this group, you know. Some person in the past that said, yeah, I'm from this country. And so that became the narrative. But, again, back to migration and people moving. You can say you're from Ireland, but if you're a person from England or Scotland, you migrated to Ireland, then you're not technically Irish.
According to the DNA, that's true, right?
According to the DNA, and it might fall out a little differently. Of course, these groups are all very closely related anyway.
Sure.
It's hard to parse out things. You know, I imagine as these databases grow and maybe sophistication in the test grows, that there might be a way to sort of tease out these different things. But, you know, this has added a lot to what people understand about their own ancestry. And certainly as we talk about, you know, people moving around the planet over the last several thousand years, lots of other interesting pieces
right.
come out of this type of testing.
Very true. Very true. My guest this morning, local archaeologist Paul Reed, is joining me. We're talking about archaeology and DNA, the science of constructing and looking into DNA, and it works in archaeological digs and evidence and materials that are found there, and also for the rest of us as well. And I guess, Paul, what I would say is hopefully this means maybe we'll cut down on the number of emails I get from Nigerian princes if we can send them through a DNA test. That's not the case.
That's right. certainly a likelihood there.
Right.
You know, as we kind of look at the larger timeline of human evolution, the DNA testing has been pretty revolutionary. You know, I think we mentioned this on a prior show, but there's of course been long debates for decades about the relationship of humans, early humans, you know, Cro-Magnon era people like 200,000 years ago, how they relate to the Neanderthals specifically, because, you know, Neanderthals were discovered in the late 19th century. This caught everyone's attention. We sort of came up with the caricature of the, quote, caveman, Neanderthal, you know, these very heavy-built people, and, you know, who were assumed to be less intelligent. Well, a lot of that's been sort of blown away by the findings of Neanderthal folks doing art, burying their dead with great care, and, you know, being very, very human-like mm-hmm. as a very closely related species. Well, what the DNA and the genetic testing has done is revealed that we and the Neanderthals actually merged at some point, so that humans more than likely absorbed Neanderthal groups through time. And ultimately, when the Neanderthal line disappeared, this is sometime right after about 30,000 years ago, one of the last good dates we have is about 28,000 years ago, that basically Neanderthal DNA was incorporated into humans. So if you do the test with National Geographic, which I haven't done myself so far, they will tell you if you have European ancestry what percentage of your DNA has been gifted to you through this long line of Neanderthal DNA.
Hmm.
And for most people of European background, they're going to have between 1.5% and 5% Neanderthal. So that has literally been carried through the line. So one of the more fascinating things about all this for me is that in our DNA encodes this history. That, you know, is not about culture, it's not about art or, you know, language or any of the things that we think make us distinctly human, but it's strictly passed through the biological line all the way through, you know, and is a very interesting component of who we are as people. So that the testing on Neanderthal remains specifically then has allowed us to clear up some of the mysteries about that. Certainly, you know, there's much more to be learned. The other thing that's come on is, you know, some of the other closely related human groups. There's a group called the Denisovans who were found in a cave in Russia, and the cave was also used by Neanderthals at a later point in time. They were able to extract some of that DNA and sort of establish those relationships. And that particular group of, you know, a human-like species lasted until, I think, 25,000 years ago. So very recently in our history, in our evolution, we had multiple human species, you know, interacting, competing perhaps on the landscape. And the DNA work has really helped us understand those relationships. One of the more interesting things as well is the people who've studied this have detected a sort of a signature, if you will, some markers through DNA through time that seem to belong to a species that we have no archaeological evidence of so far.
Wow.
You know, so in other words, some total wild card, you know, some genetic material that has survived the processes of evolution through all these many thousands of years and still is present in some humans. And, you know, we don't know exactly
right.
who that group is. So
interesting.
Plenty more to be done.
Right. Right. Of course, the term that comes to mind is maybe missing link, Paul Reed. Is that something that maybe could be considered along those lines that folks have been talking about for decades?
Right, right. You know, that I have sort of mixed emotions about the whole concept of that, because
I know that term evokes all kinds of images and what have you, right?
Right. And part of it for me is that, you know, using it as a singular word, the missing link, one single one, uno, right, is really deceiving, because what we have basically are a whole series of sort of transitions from this group to that group, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And so that's the way to think about it. The other thing that this brings up, of course, is the sort of competing views that we've had for 100 years or more of studying, you know, sort of recent human evolution is, is it just one species at a time that then becomes another and another and another? So do we have like a tree that just simply goes straight up, you know, or do we have a branching bush, is the analogy that I use when I talk about evolution. And I think what most scientists have settled on is what we have evidence for is multiple lines of both human ancestors way back millions of years, the Australopithecine group, you know, five or six of those species potentially on the planet in Africa primarily at the same time, and then going through changes and evolution. And then, you know, the Homo line, our genus, emerges, and then we have multiple versions of those species on the landscape. So we've really settled on what we describe as a multilineal pattern explanation for evolution. And that suggests that these hinge points, these transitions, the missing link points, that there's multiple ones of those as we look at them through time.
I see.
And so that, you know, so I think if we broaden the term and pluralize it, then it makes more sense.
A little more comfortable with that type of a term then. Okay. Let me ask you a bit about some of the other issues when we start talking about these types of studies, Paul Reed, about Native American groups and other ethnic groups and some of the political socio minefields that you sometimes have to negotiate if a culture has a long history of a certain story and maybe some evidence becomes available that maybe that story is a little bit different or isn't quite as folks thought, just like maybe your wife's ancestry.
Right. Right. So we do have these different competing narratives. You know, we learn certain things from DNA testing, and then we might have deep, deep oral traditions that tell people how things, you know, transgressed or how people move through time. And they don't always line up. And, you know, so I think what we have to do on that front really is just keep an open mind about it. And, you know, those of us trained in sort of a Western scientific tradition have come to feel that this is the only way to have knowledge about certain things. And, you know, at this point in my career, after having done this for 35 years, I can see that there are multiple ways to get at, you know, important aspects of this narrative. So, you know, I think we have to kind of maybe step away from thinking of this as we're seeking truth, you know, with a capital T. You know, and I think most scientists are down with that at this point, that there's not a single truth lingering out there. And the pathway to understanding whatever problem we want to understand from the past or the present is to bring these different lines of research to bear. And again, really to stay away from the concept of there's a single explanation and here's what it is. And, you know, Right. Now everything makes sense. So I think that the value is to take the oral traditions, take archaeological evidence, take DNA evidence, and put these together and see what kinds of larger narratives emerge from that. And yeah, certainly we're going to have some contradictory things and it's not all going to make sense. But, you know, that's part of the mystery of the world. If we had it all figured out, right, let's go to bed.
Well, true. That's true. But it seems to me like with some of this technology, Paul Reed, we are slowly, you and your colleagues, slowly peeling away some of those mysteries that have kind of confounded folks for millennia of where we came from, where we went, who moved where, and how these groups interacted with other groups. I mean, a lot of these answers are being answered and somewhat quite recently, correct?
Right, definitely. And I don't want to, you know, convey the impression that we're floundering about and not making progress on some of these larger questions. We definitely are. And, you know, I think that we can talk about, you know, the shortcomings, some of the problems that we have with different approaches, and science in particular has some shortcomings. But what are the strengths of a scientific approach in archaeology or anything else is that there is a constant examination of the data and new data and questioning of old assumptions to say, how does this fit in with this? You know, and then, of course, we do have, you know, sometimes scientists of a certain age, an older age, saying, no, my theory works. Younger, new people come along, they may bring new data to bear, and then we eventually sort of wind our way to a new point on that. But it's not that that's a particularly pretty process, shall we say.
Right.
You know, we joke about this in my field that archaeologists will argue about almost anything. And I think at the larger level, most people doing science and certainly crossing the lines in the humanities and literature, you know, humans are kind of a contentious bunch. We like to explore things verbally. We like to talk about them. We like to argue. I don't personally see that as a problem because, you know, we're seeking to understand things, but I don't know that, you know, back to this notion that there isn't a single truth lingering out there in archaeology, in the history of this group or that group, or that, you know, we're going to understand all of literature with this single truth. You know, it's multiple narratives, and we go through the process, try to understand those, and, you know, eventually we get some kind of consensus, and, you know, sometimes we don't, but the world moves forward, and that's okay, too.
Sure. And it seems like we're learning more and more about the world as time goes on. And some of this research is being looked into. Let me ask you a bit about what you mentioned. And certainly we know that a lot of the ancient peoples that we study, that you study, weren't as mobile as folks were in our more recent past. But is there a chance that maybe some of this DNA evidence could be a little faulty if it's saying that this group came from this area, but maybe they have genetics from that area, but they actually lived in a different area? Is that something that could kind of foul up our understanding?
Yeah, it definitely could. And one of the challenges as we go back in time is that we have sort of less and less of the actual material to sample from,
right,
know, different remains that come up. So if we're to look at, you know, the movement of Native American peoples from Asia over to North America, you know, there's pretty good data now to suggest, as we talked on a prior show, that these groups were in Northeast Asia at the 20 to 25,000 year range, that they started to move the initial wave of folks into what we call Beringia, which is the area of Alaska and the Bering Sea with sea levels much lower, with the water tied up in the ice sheets, and that people were there for a period of time and then moved into Canada and eventually into North America. So there's pretty good data on that, but, you know, the thing is, if we add more samples, new data to that, that can shift those relationships as we understand them. And, you know, this is back to why we need more data in some of these areas, just to kind of sort that out. But, you know, to the extent that we understand it with this particular group of samples from this location or another, you know, those can be considered pretty good results. You know, as we get into the more modern era and we're talking about the movements of people in Europe in particular over the last 100 years, then that's a lot of movement. And we're talking about the translocation of millions of people over the course of different social events, the political upheavals, the tremendous and catastrophic wars that occurred that pushed people into refugee status and moved them here and here and here. You know, but to some extent, what's coded in our bodies in the DNA is its own narrative, you know, its own small truth with a small t, maybe, because that does preserve the record of all of the ancestors that each of us individually had going back as many generations as we can track. If we can find DNA in people today from the Neanderthals, that's at least 30 to 35,000 years old. And, you know, those fragments of the coding of the four letters in the DNA are still present in people today. So, you know, that's an amazing record if you think about that.
Right.
And the geneticists are coming up with more and more sophisticated ways to tease out different aspects of that data and to really understand what happened. So, you know, but again, we need to add, when we want to understand human movement, we need to add the human narrative into that and bring the archaeology and oral history to bear. And I think that's when we really end up with, you know, probably the best narrative that we can put together at any point in time.
Sure. And as you mentioned before on this program, it all kind of goes into that story, and it gives you one more tool to use in your toolbox, I suppose, to interpret what you're seeing, what you're finding on the landscape after these many, many years. And as you mentioned, I guess the more people that take part in these tests, the greater then the database to compare the rest of these other things to as other folks add into it. I can only assume that's going to grow in the next decade or more.
That's right. You know, and as long as people understand the limitations of this, if they're trying to answer specific questions in their own past, and, you know, and of course there are the other concerns we should talk about, or that, you know, some of these large companies have these data on you, and then what are the rules for them sharing that with other people? And,
right,
you know, people have specific concerns. The one company called 23andMe goes sort of beyond the simple testing of, you know, here's what your ethnicity looks like, and to actually get into health profiles and say, you know, based on what we're seeing, you might be more susceptible to diabetes, you know, stage 2 or type 2 diabetes late onset. You might have a propensity for sickle cell anemia. You know, there's a whole lot of different things. So people are understandably concerned about those data. If you go through 23andMe and your data exists in this cloud database, and, you know, could that be sold to an insurance company? And then you're applying for health insurance, you know, or you're applying for Medicare potentially in a few years for some of us, right?
Right.
And the government says, well, we want to insure you, but there's this genetic data now that says this. And, you know, I'm not trying to raise concerns about conspiracies or things, but once you put data out, data are in the world. So these are things that people at least need to have their eyes open about. You know, and with the data breaches we see occasionally with, you know, credit card companies in particular, right? You've got all your data loaded up, some hacker breaks in, and, you know, 7 million records are scattered, and people have birthdays and social security numbers and the like. You know, so it's not inconceivable that the genetic testing, the DNA data, you know, could be hacked into and go and leak out. And, you know, so, but this is one of the hazards of modern living for sure.
True.
And if you're not going to, I don't know how you don't have your information out there. You'd have to live in a much more isolated place than I live currently, right? And you move.
And you're pretty off the grid too, where you are. So, yeah.
You go into your, you know, your 640 acres, your one section of land in some remote area. You grow your own food, you know, you stop using banks. And anyway,
right.
Risks of modern life. The point is just to be aware of those and you know. But I don't think there are nefarious plots underway for people's DNA to be misused. But, you know, the potential's there. And this is why
sure.
We have to pay attention as a society to their privacy.
Very true. Paul Reed is my guest this morning. He works with Salmon Ruins and Archaeology Southwest. He's joining us via Skype today from his home in the Taos area. And we just have about maybe 5 or so minutes remaining, Paul Reed. And so going back to you and your family's results from these tests, again, as you mentioned, it was somewhat confirmed in your case, somewhat not confirmed in your wife's case, but still in the ballpark, it seems to me. I mean, it wasn't totally out of whack. So these things do tend to, I guess, conform mostly to maybe what families have passed down and generation to generations. Nothing too strange.
No, and that's right, because, you know, before we had looked at Tristan's results, we were joking this morning about, well, what if it all comes back as she's from Australia, you know?
Right.
And that, you know, or, you know, Southeast Asia, where she has no indications of Lyme. So, yeah, her results came back. Europe, a little bit offset. You know, the other thing that we started thinking about, and I don't know if these data would even be available, it would probably take a lot of digging to go to MyHeritage, you know, the group, and say, okay, what does your database look like for Central Europe, right? How many people who live in Poland currently, if we're interested in Polish ancestry, have actually submitted, you know, their tests, and how strong is your database?
Right.
And the truth is, you know, I don't know specifically about Poland, but if a lot of people from there haven't done these tests, then the database that MyHeritage is using to try to compare Tristan's results is not necessarily going to find matches if those data don't exist. So the fact that she got shifted a little southeast may just indicate that more people from that part of Europe have participated in this, you know, this particular company's, you know, tests.
Right.
And the English-Irish thing, of course, is fairly fluid anyway. So, you know, those of us who have Irish primarily background, you know, like to have our issues with England, right?
I was going to say, you're not too insulted by those results.
This 800-year pattern of the English doing whatever they've done to the Irish, which is not really our topic for today. But, you know, and even with my strong Irish ancestry, as I've tracked some of these lines back and been able to connect with other people's family trees, I've got a lot of English and Scottish in mine as well.
Right.
So, you know, these areas are right next to each other.
Exactly. So, well, right. You
know, And none of us are as pure as we might imagine we are. That's the other take home, I think, is that we're all a mix of different groups, our ancestors, the movement, everything.
Right. Well, and I think we all might be amazed at, as we look at maybe history, even though we feel like folks who lived prior weren't as mobile, they probably still got around or were forced to move from time to time because of whatever, whether it's environmental or political or societal changes, right? And so that would maybe shift some of the DNA and some of who met who and who had a family with who and all those different things that then affects DNA down the line.
Right. It definitely does. And right, we talk about this a lot, about how people got around in the past. And, you know, I have to bring Chaco up at some point, Scott, right?
Brian, I'm glad you did. We got there finally.
Right. People moving from Chaco up to the Middle San Juan, Farmington, Aztec, you know, we look at that and go, well, yeah, you know, that's 50 miles all the way up to Aztec. And that would be that would take me a week, right, as a modern person to walk the Great North Road.
To walk it, sure, right.
But if you're a Pueblo runner and the year is 1050, you know, and you could probably make that in a day. And certainly if you went halfway and tagged off to a relay runner, that person gets all the way up and you've made that journey in less than a day. So certainly not something that most of us would want to do unless we're marathon runners today. But, you know, people got around in the past. They moved.
Right.
So, but the movement, particularly in Europe and Asia over the last 100 years, has been tremendously, you know, at a different scale, a much higher scale. And that has just shuffled the genetic deck pretty much. And so that makes it really interesting to try to tease these out. I think the next step for us personally on this is probably to go ahead and do an ancestry.com test for me and for Tristan and then just see how those compare.
Right.
And I'm pretty certain that they will come back different just because of, you know, connecting to a different database with more people and different programs, different algorithms that go through and compare this to this to this to this. You know, so again, if you're searching for truth, you probably don't want to do DNA testing.
True.
You know, but if you want to explore another side of who you are as a person, and certainly connecting to the research we do, another side of this group's presence, movement on the planet, you know, these are very useful tools. But as with everything, we can't take the results and just say, here we go. You know, we've done it. It's science.
Here's
the whole story.
You're the
I tell people that everything, whether it's a tree ring date, a study of projectile points or arrowheads, you know, pottery analysis, all of these things give us bits of data that can contribute to the larger narrative. And hopefully if we do our job as archaeologists well, they will do that. But the individual data points themselves probably have fairly limited, you know, usefulness until we build them into that larger narrative and then make that an interesting story about the past that we can share with people.
True. And it's important that we know that going into these things. So that's some good advice. And I imagine there's something in the fine print of when you sign up for these services that tell you exactly that.
Right. So, you know, don't take it too seriously.
There you go. All right. Very good. Well, Paul, we are out of time, but again, great show. Thank you so much for joining me and appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Scott. I will come back to Farmington and be there in person.
Okay.
We'll look for that this summer. I think the schedule may allow that. So,
well, I know you.
Great to speak with you.
You are probably chomping at the bit to get back out in the field and do some of the work that you love. So we'll look forward to that visit when you can get here to the studio. So we'll see you next month.
Good deal. Thanks,
all right,
Scott.
Thank you very much. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.